Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Now, more nonstop sports talk with the Midday 180 on 104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180 served up by Wendy's. We're live from Music City Autoplex today. John Feinstein joins us. By the way, Mike Vrabel's press conference coming up in 15 minutes. You'll hear that here on 104.5 The Zone. John, how are you?
I'm good, Jonathan. How are you guys?
We are great. Can you explain Tiger and the mob scene on 18 yesterday?
I'm not sure I can, Jonathan, because there's part of me that doesn't quite understand it. And look, let me put this in a little bit of context. I have said for years to you guys, among others, that I believe Tiger Woods is the greatest golfer of all time. All due respect to Jack Nicklaus. I think when he was at his dominant best between 1997 and 2008, he did things that no one, including Nicklaus, ever did. Winning a Masters by 12, a U.S. Open by 15, winning four straight majors in 2000 and the start of 2001, and I can go on and on and on. And I would also say that I think his comeback this year has been remarkable, that he went from many people thinking his career was over, including him, to playing very good, consistent golf throughout the year, having chances to win, and finally closing the deal yesterday. So all of that's very impressive. And I understand why people want to watch. I understand why people are fascinated by this sort of comeback. I don't completely understand the emotion attached to him. This is not one of the all-time good guys. This is a guy who did terrible things to his wife and to his children, who has consistently through the years not really wanted to sign autographs, been disdainful of the media, stalked off frequently when he didn't play well. Now, I think he's improved in all those categories this year. He still doesn't say anything terribly interesting to the media, but after he missed the cut in the U.S. Open, played poorly both days, he came and talked both days. That, in the old days, didn't used to happen. And I think he's signing more autographs. He's more conscious of the public. He's made an attempt to get along with other players. That's all much better. But I still don't completely get that what we saw yesterday, not to mention, I mean, Dan Hicks, I think, is about as good as it gets on TV. But he called it the greatest comeback in the history of sports. He didn't win a major championship. He won a golf tournament. And, you know, to me, Ben Hogan, who almost died in a car accident and came back to win six more majors, that's the greatest comeback in the history of golf. Don't even get me started on Muhammad Ali or some of the other comebacks in sports. So I don't completely understand the hysteria. I do understand the fascination.
Let me try to at least give you my theory on the emotion to it, John, and just tell me what you think about this. I think it's nostalgia. I think that Tiger Woods is such a big part of a lot of people who just started watching golf because of Tiger Woods. He's such a big part of their sporting life, and he was sold in such a way by Nike and the way that he was marketed over the years. I think a lot of people, and I'm one of them, watched that yesterday with such fascination because even though it wasn't all that long ago, it brought me back to the time where you watched every golf tournament because of Tiger Woods. And there was something that felt good about that, all other Tiger Woods issues aside. Does that make sense?
You know, Chad, I think you make a good point. And I'm older than you and older than a lot of the people you're describing. Nostalgia for me is Tom Watson at his peak, because I am considerably older than a lot of those fans and a lot of players, younger players who grew up watching Tiger Woods and aspiring to be like him if possible. I do get that part of it. I get the nostalgia part of it. And I guess also, to be honest, I'm jaded because I've seen Tiger Woods up close and personal dating back to 1996, and it hasn't always been pretty. And it's hard for me to put those memories aside. So my memories of Tiger Woods aren't quite as nostalgically and filmy as maybe some others are. And that's why I believe I'm in a distinct minority in not getting all gooey-eyed over him winning. And again, I'm not taking away from how impressive it was and how remarkable this comeback is to become a very good player again. But I don't get the chills that I got, say, watching Army almost beat Oklahoma on Saturday night. That gave me chills.
John, yesterday with Tiger Woods marching up to the 18th green, it almost served as kind of a pep rally for the upcoming Ryder Cup also. The USA chant broke out with Tiger and Rory McIlroy on the green at the same time. Justin Rose having just captured the FedEx Cup also. I thought that was interesting and really had to help in terms of interest in the Ryder Cup for people who tuned over to watch that. All of the talk of the upcoming Ryder Cup and hearing that USA chant, I think it's going to have a lot of interest no matter what, but really helped.
Yeah, and it wasn't an accident that NBC was more than happy to hear that chanting and to be talking about the Ryder Cup, because obviously they're going to be televising the Ryder Cup starting on Friday. I don't think that kind of chant belongs in a regular golf tournament. Again, maybe that's the curmudgeon in me. I wonder how people would have felt if there had been European fans there who broke into the Olé song when Justin Rose made the putt on 18 to clinch winning the FedEx Cup. I wouldn't have thought that was appropriate. This was not the Ryder Cup. It was a golf tournament. It was an individual event. I think there are a lot of people out there who will use any excuse to break out the USA chant. The first time I ever heard it was at Lake Placid in 1980. And that was absolutely chill-inducing, spellbinding, whatever you want to call it. It was an amazing scene. But to me, now it's 38 years old. It's gotten kind of old for me.
What's your forecast for the Ryder Cup?
Paul, you're working.
And how's it go? Hi. How's it go again?
We have the same response.
Yeah, I was up at 4:50 this morning to catch a flight. Thanks, fellas.
I know. You have the hardest life. As I say to my 7-year-old daughter, you have the hardest life ever lived.
It's true. How do you project the Ryder Cup going, and what's conventional wisdom? Are you in line with it or opposite?
Well, the conventional wisdom is that the U.S. is going to win. Even though the U.S. hasn't won overseas since 1993 at the Belfry, which was my first Ryder Cup, and it was that Ryder Cup which inspired me to want to write the first major, and it only took 23 years to get around to it, because, you know, Tiger Woods is playing great. Phil Mickelson, no matter how he's playing, lately at least, has shown up to play well in the Ryder Cup. Brooks Koepka has had the best year of anybody in the sport. Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed are now veteran Ryder Cuppers, as is Ricky Fowler. So there's good reason to think the U.S. will win. But remember, they're playing it in Europe. The golf course will be set up for the Europeans, just as Hazeltine was set up for the Americans. The fairways will be narrow, the rough will be high, the greens will be slow, as opposed to Hazeltine, where the fairways were wide, the rough was low, and the greens were fast, because that's the way the Americans like it. That's part of the home course advantage. The thing that Europe has going against it is, last time they had 6 rookies, this time they still have 5. And Sergio Garcia had a terrible summer. He's been a great Ryder Cup player for a long time, but he had a terrible summer, and Thomas Bjorn felt he needed to pick him because of his experience, and I agreed with the pick, by the way. I think the Americans should be favored, but I wouldn't be stunned if Europe won. How's that for a good cop-out answer?
John Feinstein with us. John, Oklahoma-Army game, I'm only following it on my phone Saturday night.
Because it was only on pay-per-view.
Well, I barely even saw highlights, so... So let me get this right. Army held the ball for 44 minutes and 41 seconds against Oklahoma. They ran 87 plays in that game to Oklahoma's 40. How did that turn out? Like, why could Oklahoma not solve whatever Army was doing in this game?
Well, the Army option is very good. They've got four good fullbacks. They've got a really good slot back and a kid named Kel Walker, who's very explosive. And even though their quarterback is only in his fourth game as a starter, taking over for Ahmad Bradshaw, who was absolutely brilliant last year, he's improved in every game. And that their offensive line, this is the most amazing thing, lost four of their five starters, and yet is still blocking well enough to allow them to run the ball the way they've been able to run it. Here's a statistical quirk. Army's first two drives, which both ended in touchdowns, were 16 plays and 16 plays. Oklahoma scored touchdowns on its first three drives and needed a total of 16 plays to score those three touchdowns. So that was the contrast in the game. Then both defenses settled down in the second half, and Army actually had the ball for 19 plays on a fourth quarter drive, but a penalty pushed them back a little bit, and then on third and 12 they threw an interception. Otherwise, the game might have ended with Army kicking a field goal at the buzzer. I mean, it was that close to Army pulling one of the all-time upsets. I've seen some people say that there's some statistic that shows that Old Dominion beating Virginia Tech was the biggest upset in college football history, and it was certainly a huge upset. But if Army had won that game, it would have been a bigger upset than Old Dominion beating Virginia Tech by a wide margin. And I don't know if you saw it, Jonathan, but there was a neat scene at the end of the game. As the Army players were leaving the field, the entire crowd at Memorial Stadium gave them a standing ovation.
That's awesome.
John,
yeah, showed a lot of class.
John, you've made the wise decision to go into the YA category with your latest book, The Prodigy. Tell us a little bit about the book, and I know you're excited about it.
Yeah, Chad, this one was really a lot of fun because of my love for golf and because I know my way around the golf tour. I've been to the Masters 27 times, and The Prodigy is set at Augusta during the Masters, and it's about a 17-year-old kid who actually has a chance to win the Masters, which isn't as far-fetched as you might think. Ken Venturi almost won it as an amateur years ago. Sergio Garcia was in contention as an 18-year-old before he turned pro. But the book isn't just about the competition, although it is about that a lot, and there's a real surprise ending at the finish. But there are a lot of real people who appear, Rory McIlroy and Phil Mickelson and Zach Johnson and Justin Rose. And Tiger makes a cameo because when I was writing the book, I didn't know if he was going to play this year because I had to write it last fall to get it out now. And it gets into a lot of the issues young players face with agents and overeager parents, i.e. Earl Woods, among others. And there's, of course, a heroic reporter. And as I said, it comes down to a very surprise ending on Sunday. It was great fun. The best thing about the fiction for me, Chad, is that I can use my experience as a reporter and create a storyline around those experiences. So I hope the book feels real to people reading it.
John Feinstein, every Monday with us. John, thank you so much. We'll catch up next week.
All right, guys. Look forward to it. Thanks.